Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina. Today is November 15th, 2012. Thank you so much for tuning in to these shows. We always have the latest cutting-edge information. We have innovative thoughts from Alan Phillips and what he proposes as potential legal issues along this line. And you can also, when we want to educate you and we want to involve you in this movement about learning what are your rights and how do you stand up for them and what's going on in your state, because my gosh, if you might be the one that secedes from the union based on what we have been hearing in the news lately, that would really be, to my mind, abandonment and not really a great marriage. So we have to stick it out and work together and find solutions. Tell your friends to join the show, listen, click the Twitter button, click the Facebook button, get people to come on and find out what's going on here. And other ways that you can do that is to link it up to Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, and the other websites. Embed the code into your own show if you'd like. And, you know, we have the chat open. So if you're listening, we will take your comments. And if you want, you can call in to 347-945-6956 if you're in the United States and via Skype if you're outside the United States. So, Alan, you're going to bring us on with some important news, whatever you have on your desk.
Good afternoon, Debbie. As always, there's a lot of things going on here. First thing I wanted to mention was an article posted on the Age of Autism. It's ageofautism.com. There's a lot of people are already aware to one degree or another. Famous actress Jenny McCarthy has been very outspoken in the autism community and has challenged and criticized vaccines. I believe she has an autistic child herself, and that's what brought her into the arena. Jenny McCarthy has a column in the Chicago Sun-Times. It's a parenting column. And an organization called Every Child by Twos, claiming to be a parent advocate organization, but it's an organization that is heavily funded by the pharmaceutical industry and has among their board members Dr. Paul Offit, who has become one of the vaccine industry spokespeople. He was a co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine and has estimated to have been earned more than $10 million from that, so he's hardly an objective person on the vaccine issue. But Every Child by Twos was demanding that the Chicago Sun-Times, that they remove Jenny McCarthy's parenting column because of her pro-vaccine safety stance. And the short story is that the Chicago Sun-Times editor said no, they're going to keep her and her column. So the Age of Autism is running an article on this, and they're asking folks to send an email to the editor. His name is Jim Kirk. It's J Kirk, K-I-R-K, J Kirk at suntimes.com, S-U-N-T-I-M-E-S, suntimes.com. And thank him. I did so myself. Just a really quick note saying thank you for keeping Jenny McCarthy's parenting column there. Let him know that there is there are many people who appreciate there be excuse me, there being some space in the Chicago Sun-Times and anywhere else, for that matter, for people to express legitimate concerns, whether Big Pharma likes it or not.
So that's one way that people can get involved, by sending messages to people who are publishing in the media out there, one point of view or another. You can take action by sending a note of appreciation and thanks that two sides of an issue are being given to the public. That's yeah. Really, really important.
That there is a legitimate alternative view or other side to the status quo on vaccines that we get from most medical authorities. Although there is some mix there. One of the things we haven't seen really break open the vaccine controversy into the mainstream arena is people arguing the science. And ultimately, it is an issue about the science and medicine. And ultimately, we absolutely need to get clarity and truth out in the open, and the reasons that there is resistance to that from those who have a vested interest, financially or otherwise, in seeing everyone be vaccinated with every vaccine. But I think one of the things that ultimately will bring this issue increasingly into the open and into the mainstream is going to be conflicts within the mainstream community itself. And we have some more and more of that going on, where we have people right out of the mainstream speaking out, or people acting or speaking through their actions to say, wait a minute, this enough is enough, or this is going too far, or whatever it may be. So here's a specific example from UPI.com, a recent article that's saying that a quarter of EMTs, that's the emergency medical technicians? EMTs, a quarter of EMTs don't get the flu vaccine. This comes from St. Louis. And 60% of the EMTs who didn't get the vaccine said that they don't trust public health authorities when they say the influenza vaccine is safe. A third of the EMTs who didn't get vaccinated said that the flu vaccine has a lot of side effects and reported being afraid of those. And more than half in this unvaccinated group also said they don't believe they can play a role, the vaccines can play a role in transmitting, or no, that they, the EMTs, that they can play a role in transmitting influenza to their patients if they're not vaccinated. So this is really interesting, that increasingly there is dissension among the ranks, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have the same concerns as the general public. If they are reading the news, and if they are questioning authority, and if they have had their own personal experience with the vaccines themselves, because how many people do you know, especially to me, middle-aged and elderly people, have had the flu vaccine and then come away down with a horrendous side effects, or getting the flu basically for a couple of weeks, and then it's a difficult road to recovery. So if they're seeing it and experiencing it in their lives, then they're taking to heart what they actually observe, and they're reassessing information that's being given to them as rote and things that they actually know as real.
Well, and this is interesting too, because the people in the medical profession, or many of them, have a frontline view of what's actually going on. And you can show somebody the results of a study, but if that's not what you're seeing in the real world, how reliable is the study? Even though what you're seeing in the real world is anecdotal evidence and not in and of itself formal scientific proof. But there's a point at which if somebody can show you all the studies in the world telling you that the sun doesn't shine, but if you're seeing the sun shine, it's just somewhere there's a problem with that. As I keep mentioning, just because it's been so unusual this fall that I've been, compared to any previous year, flooded with emails and calls, and majority of my clients this fall are healthcare workers trying to avoid the mandatory flu vaccines in hospitals for all the hospital workers, whether they have anything to do with patients or not. One of my recent clients has been an ICU, intensive care unit nurse, for 30 years, and she says she's never seen a flu death. Where are all these flu deaths we keep hearing about? She's not seeing them.
That's true.
And it's sort of interesting, and I'm not suggesting that no one ever dies from a flu or flu complication, related complication, but another in this article about EMTs in St. Louis, 25% of the 265 St. Louis EMTs said they don't believe that influenza is a serious disease that can cause death. And this is
It is not the influenza itself. It is the secondary bacterial infections like pneumonia. That's what causes the deaths. And it's for people who have autoimmune diseases, for people who already have weakened vital forces, who are not able to withstand having any kind of an illness on top of the problems that they already have.
But you see, Debbie, I hear you on that, but it's really not a health issue, because I'm hearing from healthcare workers from all over the country. I've worked with healthcare workers in at least a couple of dozen, or about a couple of dozen states. And there's a recent article in The Lancet that says the flu vaccine is only about 60% effective. And I've seen critiques of that study that show that even that figure is misleading. But let's take it at face value. 40% of the people who get the flu shot are not protected, and that's only if they guess the strains right. If they don't get the strain, they have to guess what are going to be the dominant strains, which changes potentially from year to year, and they have to
This is written where again?
It's a study published in The Lancet.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and then there are references to that in some of the articles that are linked on the news page of the Pandemic Response Project. That's pandemicresponseproject.com. But here's the point, though, Debbie, that 40% of, according to this study, over 40% of people who get the flu vaccine aren't protected, assuming that you get the strains right, because if they don't get the strains right, then nobody's protected. But let's just give them the benefit of the doubt, and let's take the study at face value and say, okay, we use their figures. 40% of the people who get the shot aren't protected. But hospitals around the country are not testing any of the vaccinated people who work with the immunocompromised patients, the ones who are supposedly at risk from complications from the flu. So you don't want somebody, under the mainstream views, you don't want somebody who's not vaccinated working with these immunocompromised patients, or somebody who's not immune. But 40% of the vaccinated people, according to mainstream medicine, are not protected, and they're not immune, but the hospitals are not testing to see which of the vaccinated people are not immune and telling them they have to wear masks or they can't go work with immunocompromised patients. If it was a health issue, they'd be doing that. They'd be testing people. They'd be saying, we know you got your shot. Thank you for doing your, social duty there and getting your shot, and also to keep us from firing you. But if it's really a health issue, they've got to test those people to find out which ones are in that 40%. That's a huge percentage. It's not like you're saying 1% or 2%. See, the herd immunity theory, let's pretend that it works with vaccines, because it really doesn't. It's been disproven many times. But let's pretend it works, because it's still white for the moment, to make a point.
We have to go with the hypothesis, yes. We have
for the sake of the point, let's assume the herd immunity theory works. Well, you still have to have, 90-95% or more people vaccinated, because a small percentage of the vaccinated people are not going to be immune, and you have to vaccinate everybody or almost everybody in order to have a high enough percentage of people who are immune that you then have that herd immunity effect. And while they keep changing the numbers over time, 80%, and then, there's an outbreak. Oh, it must be 85%, and there's an outbreak. Oh, it must be 90%. So the figures have varied and gone up over recent decades. But they'll generally tell you something in the vicinity of you have to have 90 or 95% or more people vaccinated to get that herd immunity effect. Well, if 40% of the vaccinated people are not immune, you cannot get herd immunity with the flu vaccine. And you've got patients coming in all the time who aren't vaccinated anyway. There's just no way that you would ever be able to get herd immunity in a hospital setting with the flu vaccine. It's just not medically or scientifically possible.
Their
and
numbers
even,
are all mixed up.
Yeah, and even if everybody in the hospital was vaccinated and the vaccine was 100% effective, people who are immune can still breathe in and out flu viruses, and they're still on the doorknobs, and, you know, flu virus is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's in the air. It's on things. It's on people coming in and out of the hospital. So herd immunity is just not a plausible goal. But again, the point is it's not a health concern, because if it was a health concern, they'd have to be testing the people who work with immunocompromised patients at least, if not everybody else. And they're not doing that. And this
right.
is, you know, nobody has ever said to me, oh, yeah, they're testing people in our hospital to make sure that they have, you know, that none of the immunocompromised people get the flu.
Since we're talking about the flu, why don't we just move right over to the Tamiflu, which in the University of Georgia, their website says that it doesn't offer relief as is promised in the study. For nearly 62 million Americans who have been infected with influenza each year, it's called the oseltamivir, commonly called Tamiflu, promises, you know, everybody says, get the Tamiflu, it's the easiest way to get your protection. But new research says that have not all the benefits flu sufferers and doctors were hoping for, based on published trials and the conventional wisdom that we thought that the Tamiflu prevents complications and prevents hospitalizations and is especially good in the vulnerable populations. But we didn't find anything that supports that, basically said by Mark Ebel, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the UGA College of Public Health. And this was based on a meta-analysis of 3 published and 8 unpublished double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials of the Tamiflu in several countries between 1997 and the years 2000. Well, that's some time back. I don't know whether they've reformulated the Tamiflu to make it any different than what kind of outcomes they would have gotten. But what does that mean to the public who trusts the medical community and looks to them for answers, solutions, and protection? And we find out years later that what they took, I don't know how much money the Tamiflu company earned on that one, but that none of it, they even say bursting the bubble probably. Burst your bubble about what you believe. Tamiflu prevents respiratory cells from bursting open and releasing viral particles. Once cells begin to burst, the medication loses its effectiveness. So too often, physicians hoping to help the ailing patients will write prescriptions long after the 24-hour window of treatment closes. So really, it's a time you have to get the Tamiflu in a specific amount of time, and usually you're getting that after the window has closed, based on the way that this drug works.
Yeah, I love this. There's a one paragraph here where they say they saw a small difference in the likelihood that pneumonia would develop in those patients who were later confirmed to have influenza, but it was only a 0.9% reduction. In other words, less than a 1% reduction. That's not a small difference. That's a completely irrelevant finding. You know,
so
that's small of a number. It's statistically irrelevant. Statistically
right.
insignificant.
So, you
would
know
be a
what I would
word.
Love? I would love to see in the University of Georgia and all the other affiliated with medical hospitals and medical schools, what if they did a study and they gave everyone sunlight, you know, the little light boxes, and they gave everybody in, if they'd put those lights in the ceilings of all the hospitals, everybody would get well and leave anyway. And if they were handing out little cups of vitamin D as you enter the hospital, I mean, this is an imaginary pie in the sky kind of world that I'm describing, a utopian universe where people were doing studies of things that people can just go to the regular store and get either in the health food store or, you know, have bowls of apples. I just read that there's an apple a day keeps the doctor away. and that it's actually true. let me see if I can find that.
Is this because people are throwing their apples at the doctors and the doctors are, you know, staying away then, or?
No, I'm going to search for that article so that I can tell you.
Because then you might need two or three apples in case your aim isn't that good and you miss on the first throw. So I just was concerned about that.
But it says, in a study of healthy middle-aged adults, consuming an apple a day for 4 weeks lowered blood levels of a probable contributor to arterial sclerosis or hardening of the arteries by 40%. The study found that apples lowered blood levels of oxidized low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, according to lead researcher Robert DeSilvestro, a professor in Ohio State's Department of Human Nutrition and scientist with the University's Ohio Agricultural Research and Development Center. And so, I mean, wow, your great-great-grandparents were telling you, eat an apple a day, keep the doctor away. And, you know, most people I speak to today say they don't want to go to the doctor. And they try everything in their power to do something on their own. So what if there were, in my day, I'm going on and on, waxing on and on about this, but when I went to high school, we had apple machines. We didn't have candy machines. We didn't have soap.
What planet was this?
This was on Long Island. We had a very advanced school, I guess. No, we had apple machines, and it was such a treat that the apples were juicy and delicious and sweet and large, and they were gorgeous. This was something that the students really looked forward to. So, I mean, we need to institute these old, timey things that we used to do.
Certainly some of them, don't we? So there you have it, folks. The apple a day has some basis in science. So many customs and things that develop over time probably really come from people's observations. And observations, of course, are not in and of themselves scientific proof of anything, because people can misperceive or misunderstand what they're observing. But I tell you, a lot of this really is just common sense. You know, if it works, do it. And then if you want to later try to figure out scientifically why or how, that's great. But
right. So,
you know, this is what I say when people
going
criticize.
Back to observation. Going back
people,
to observation. How do you feel when you take certain amount of drinks and eat fresh fruits and vegetables? How do you feel? Take note of your inner self talking to you. Go ahead. I cut you off.
No, that's fine. It's like when people say homeopathy doesn't work because it can't work, and that comes from people whose thinking is narrow or limited in that they cannot imagine a mechanism outside of the ones they're already familiar with by which homeopathy or anything else could work, and so they say, well, it can't work. There's nothing there physically in these extreme dilutions, and it's sort of like saying, before the discovery of nuclear physics, the sun didn't shine. I mean, if the sun is shining, you don't say, let me see whether or not it can shine. Let me study the science and see if we can figure out whether or not it really is shining. You say, okay, it is shining, and science, the truly appropriately applied science, tries to explain what you observe. It doesn't try to decide whether or not what you observe is really there to be observed at all in the first place, for the most part anyway. But Debbie, we have just tons of empirical evidence and scientific evidence supporting the reality that homeopathy does work consistently and effectively for a broad range of ailments and issues. And the question is not, does it work? The question could be reasonably, for those who don't already know the answer, why does it work or how does it work? And let's explore that. Let's, you know, research that, and let's learn more about it over time so that we can better apply it and so forth. But it's just so silly. I really think it's a good analogy. Oh, the sun didn't shine until we discovered nuclear physics. Okay, I'm glad to know that.
I agree with you. I think we have to take ownership of what we observe in our own lives and trust in our inner innate sensibilities and not just let people tell us things and then take it at face value. I think that maybe that's where we're turning. And who knows where it's going to lead us. I mean, of course, I do think that we do learn quite a bit. I mean, if we didn't learn about the atoms and about the galaxies, and that's all from tools beyond our visual perception, our five senses. Although I just heard about, did you hear this on NPR? The people who are kind of putting implants of robots in their body, and they're adding more senses than they already have. Are you there?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean.
Well, people are.
You mean like Geordi on Star Trek, who has beyond the visual.
Absolutely.
Normal visual range, that kind of thing?
People are having little implants, like a couple of people on the show where they're having in their fingertips implants to get information to their body about like electromagnetic fields or about musical. They can hear the music in a different sense. And so like this one lady, when she goes near her microwave oven, she will get sensations in her fingers when she feels that electromagnetic field, where depending on where she's standing, she can actually sense how far out that radiation is coming into her space, into her room. I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I would do that. No, I don't. I would say they're thinking of it like instead of just wearing glasses, now you're wearing contact lenses, now you're wearing implants. So they're talking about having all of these types of implants. And you've seen the ones where having, instead of walking around with your mobile device or your internet, you're now going to have something implanted into your brain or your glasses or your vision so that you can just move your eyes or whatever you do and you can pull up your website. I don't know. It's really fantastic, like science fiction that's become real.
Trying to stretch convenience as far as the imagination will allow it. It's an interesting idea to translate things in our physical world that are beyond our physical senses, to translate that into physical senses so that we can relate, perceive to it, or understand it in a direct way. It's an interesting idea to approach that technologically, because there's another way to approach that, and that's just developing our innate intuition or psychic senses. Those are senses that everybody has and can develop, and so you can ultimately access any information with the mind. You just have to develop those innate senses and abilities that we all have, and there are a number of different systems out there that people can access to get in touch with and develop those abilities. So I'd be more comfortable with doing it naturally with our innate capabilities than I would be with putting in physical implants, because when you approach it that way, you're always talking about, in one way or another, one degree or another, what's the side effects or downside of it.
Side effects or dependency or something that crashes in the digital age that doesn't work, the power goes out, or you can get zapped if you go through some kind of electromagnetic field that all of your appliances that you're attached to you fail. And I love what you said about using your mind. I mean, you can take an example of somebody who is living the regular normal life, and then they get in an accident and they become blind. They unfortunately, God forbid, they lose their sight. And then they start to develop their other sensibilities to a heightened degree. And I guess the problem is that it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort to heighten your other senses. And instead of just saying, okay, just put it in, like getting a transplant, you know, one of the bands, gastric bands, so that you don't eat, and it's the reverse, though, you don't feel anything. So when you're eating, so now, or actually it is the same. It's a heightened sensibility that you're full. So in the same sense, using a crutch or an additional piece of equipment, instead of developing and retraining yourself, that's a lot of work to and probably time to get that far.
Yeah, it probably is for a lot of people. You know, I saw a fascinating show where a blind person rode a bicycle and navigated obstacles using echolocation. He was able to make clicking sounds and, in effect, do what bats do, for example, when they fly. And so it's fascinating that we have, you know, a lot of interesting examples of people who have heightened senses of different kinds. And yes, for most people, it does take a concerted focus and effort to develop these. And it's like anything, any other ability. Some people will have natural ability and be able to do it better and quicker than others. But it'll be interesting to see, because, and we're sort of off topic here, but I think
you know what? I'm just
figuring
about,
that out.
I am actually just thinking about it and writing about it on Facebook. Are we off topic? So you read my mind.
Yeah.
We are.
Well, see,
yes,
I'm developing my intuitive abilities, but
I think there's
an evolutionary. There's an evolution question there as well too. I think it's where we're going as a species evolutionarily. Uh-huh. So it will probably become increasingly feasible over time for more and more people to approach and develop these things with less and less effort and focus that would perhaps be required presently. But let me bring up an interesting situation that came up in my work and bring us back into vaccines. I got a call from was contacted by a parent whose child was about to be moved from the child's classroom to another classroom, and it was a very small class, may have been some special education students, but in any case, the mother was very concerned that this was going to be emotionally difficult for the child. And the reason they wanted to move the child is because the child was not vaccinated, the parents had a religious exemption, and nobody was questioning the validity of the exemption. But nonetheless, this child was not vaccinated, and so they wanted to move the child because the teacher was pregnant. And the teacher felt that an unvaccinated child posed a risk to the teacher for probably rubella in particular. And it's a real interesting scenario because somebody operating under the fear-based mainstream propaganda as opposed to the mainstream information. You know, I love to pull up information that is considered not mainstream and challenges mainstream, but I love even more when I have a situation where we can pull up the mainstream information and show these people that they are in conflict with themselves. Because that's probably a very reasonable reaction for somebody who's operating under the fear-based hype about vaccines and disease and the risk and so forth. Oh, I'm pregnant. Here's an unvaccinated child, that's a risk to me and my unborn child. And while there are no 100% guarantees anywhere, in my working with these folks...
Was that mother vaccinated against these diseases?
I don't have that piece of information. But the question was, does the unvaccinated child pose a risk to the pregnant mother such that the pregnant mother should... who is a teacher, should change, or pregnant mother-to-be, such that the pregnant teacher needed to change classrooms.
The teacher needed to change classroom or the child?
Excuse me. The initial decision was to move the child to another classroom. This child is a threat to this teacher. We're not going to move the teacher and traumatize the whole class. We're just going to move the one student. We'll just traumatize the one student by making that student change classes. I mean, I'm sure there are some kids who could change classes and handle it okay, but you do that after a child is already established, and these parents were concerned that in their particular situation this would be traumatic for the child, and they objected to it. And there's both a medical and a legal question here. Is it a medical, legitimate medical concern? And regardless of anybody's opinion on that, legally, can they do that? Can they change a child whose parents are exercising a perfectly valid religious exemption? Can they move the child to another classroom because the teacher or the administration is concerned about the safety of the teacher? And, you know, sometimes it really does make sense, Debbie, to break these things apart into what's the medical analysis and what's the legal analysis. But the medical and legal analyses ultimately go hand in hand. And so... on the medical side, the CDC tells us that 5 to 15% of vaccinated kids don't develop immunity. And if you look at the medical literature with some vaccines, it's even more than that. Like we were talking about earlier, the flu vaccine, only 60% effective on a good day. And so it's not as simple as which children are vaccinated and which children are unvaccinated. And this is a mistake that even the, from what I can tell, the vast majority of mainstream medical doctors, they make this error, and others, error in relation to their own mainstream medical information. And it boils down to this. People want to relate to concerns about vaccination in non-emergency situations where there's not already an outbreak or a pandemic or whatever, but just in the routine immunization sense where you're immunizing somebody for the protection of hypothetical future exposure to disease. People want to make this a black and white issue where if you're vaccinated, you're protected, and if you're not vaccinated, you're not protected, and they want to make it an issue about individual immunity or vaccination status, and that's not what vaccination is about. Vaccination protection in a community is not about the vaccination status or the immune status of individuals. It's about the group. It all goes back to this same herd immunity thing. If the group is protected, everybody's protected. If the most people in the group are immune, everybody's protected. And that has been erroneously translated into if most people are vaccinated, everybody's protected. So here's the deal. The CDC tells us that vaccines don't work in everybody. 5 to 15% of kids who get vaccines are not protected. The CDC also tells us that non-vaccinated people can get this rare condition that most people have never heard of. It's called natural immunity. and to bring it back to a more serious point, though, that the CDC tells us, their website says, you can get natural immunity without even developing symptoms. So the bottom line is, you cannot tell somebody's immune status by their vaccination status. And so if the mother is really concerned, this teacher, pregnant mother-to-be, pregnant teacher is really concerned, they would have to test all of the children, vaccinated or not, to see which ones are immune and which ones aren't immune. But that would even be a fallacy because it's not about which vaccines didn't work or which children have or don't have natural immunity if they're not vaccinated. It's about, are the majority of people immune? Because if the majority of people are immune, then everybody's protected. And if most people are vaccinated under the mainstream theory, then most of them are going to be immune and everybody's protected. So it's not about the...
But it's actually the opposite. It's all about the pregnant mother. Does she have a susceptibility to any particular disease, or is she have a strong immune system, and is she personally protected? That's really what it's about. And why limit it to the classroom, the kids in that classroom? Does she go to the lunchroom? Does she see the other kids in the school? Does she, you know, do bus monitoring? Does she, you know, all the different things. She's exposed all the time. Does she go to the grocery store? People are exposed all the time. I don't think that you can limit it down to the kids in the class.
You know, it's a really good point. I actually didn't get as far in my thinking to ask, is the mother immunized? But I did get as far in my, and I say that with some embarrassment now. It's sort of like the obvious, as you, now that you mention it. But I did, of course, get as far in my thinking to say that if the mother's really concerned, she needs to stay home while she's pregnant because the risk of exposure is anywhere and everywhere. And even at home, if she has a husband who goes to work and comes home and is around people, there's still a risk there. So, you know, there's
I think the idea is that being around someone for a lengthy period of time who potentially could bring the germ into the space where she is her concern. That, you know, it's not the quick brush with the other person at the grocery line, although that could do it if the person touches something or sneezes or whatever, but it's the constant proximity of the two people. That's, I think, what they're talking about, the concern.
Sure. And because even if the mother was vaccinated, since vaccines don't work 100% of the time, maybe she's still vulnerable anyway. But if that was her concern, that would just support the same argument of saying that her concern, if it is, if there is a concern with individuals, and I believe that the herd immunity theory tells us, no, there's not a concern about individuals, only about groups. But if there is a concern about individuals, then she's going to have herself tested. She's going to have
right.
all the students tested to find out who has vaccine or natural immunity and who doesn't. So it's an interesting situation. I think what they were talking about doing, and I don't know if I've gotten confirmation on this yet, maybe it's in my email inbox, but they were talking perhaps as an alternative to moving the teacher instead of the student. I guess the class as a whole could tolerate changing teachers more easily and with less trauma than an individual child could handle being singled out and moved to another class. But I don't think that really addresses the problem either, because as you say, Debbie, unless she comes into school in a bubble and then stays in that classroom and vaccinated children can, you know, maybe if the vaccine works and the vaccinated child doesn't get sick, that doesn't mean that they're not exposed to a germ and still passing it around to other people. So it's the whole notion that of vaccination equals immunity for you and everybody around you is flawed. On the legal analysis, just real quick, and the legal analyses, because the law is not going to ever allow somebody to be unreasonably exposed. When state legislatures around the country enacted vaccines exemptions, they are presumed to have considered whether or not the exercise of those exemptions is going to put anybody else at risk, of any significant risk. And presumably because of the herd immunity theory, they reasoned that, you know, a small number of exemptions are fine, and then they pass the laws. But regardless, when a law is passed, an exemption law is passed, it carries with it a legal presumption that the exercise of that exemption is a safe thing to do, or the law wouldn't have been passed. So if somebody disagrees with that, if they say exercising the exemption puts people at risk, they're welcome to disagree, but you don't get to take the law into your own hands and go changing things any way you want to. You have to go back to the state legislature with that disagreement, because the state legislature has already decided that the exercise of the exemption is okay. It doesn't cause a significant health risk for anyone. And if you disagree with that, you've got to go back to them and ask them to change the laws. And if they change the laws, then that legal presumption will change along with it. But until the laws change, there's a legal presumption that the exercise of an exemption does not put anybody at any kind of significant health risk. And so whether it's a medical analysis or a legal analysis, you come up to the same conclusion, and you should, because if your medical and legal analyses are not consistent, then one of them is wrong and needs to be fixed, because the law is not ever going to arbitrarily put someone at risk. Now, I say that, and then I turn around and say, well, the vaccine mandates do put people at risk, and that's a problem. Well, we need to go back to the state legislature and change those laws. And that's our recourse. If we disagree, if we think vaccines aren't safe and effective, we need to go back to the legislatures and address the problem there, because they have already decided that the vaccines are safe and effective and necessary, or they wouldn't have enacted the laws mandating them. Now, I'm talking legal analysis here, not necessarily my personal opinion about reality.
Mm-hmm.
But so please understand that this is
I think,
a legal analysis.
I think that we're going to be continually getting more and more information. Like if we had a scale, like a legal scale, a balance scale, and we kept dropping little small weights, gold coins on one side of the balance, and slowly it's going to turn the tide, and the other, you know, it's going to outweigh the other side of information. Things like the recent article of stemming mumps outbreak by using a third vaccination, despite the ineffectiveness of the MMR vaccine and also lawsuits claiming fraud. What is going on? If two booster shots are ineffective, let's do a third one. It's the old saying from Einstein that's attributed to Einstein about, you know, insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and not getting any different result.
Yeah,
why?
Expecting a different result.
What?
Expecting, doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah,
that's
insanity. That is insanity. So why are we now insane? Why do we continually, I believe in persistence. I believe in perseverance. I believe in dedication and trying something over and over again to make sure that you didn't miss something, that, you know, perhaps the next time it's going to work. But there comes a time where you have to say, let's stop. We have to admit wrong, and we have to try to look at it in an objective way with more clarity and all of the data in front of us. And then, you know, we do have to say we're sorry. I mean, for all the people who have been affected by past mistakes, historically being given millions, billions of dollars of drugs that don't work, that's why we have recalls, because mistakes have been made. And now we have to think not just individually about this particular drug or that particular drug being a mistake because of not looking clearly at all of the side effects and what it's doing to the total body, but now we have to look at our principles, our theories behind the way that we are providing these medications. So and vaccinations. So do you want to take a closer look at that article by Mercola?
Well, it's an interesting issue here. You know, you're thinking in reasonable, common sense, practical terms here. You're missing the point. If you've got an opportunity to give another vaccine or to quit, you have to think, first of all, which one's going to make you more money? And that's what you have to base your decision on. So, of course, they're going to give a third one. If that doesn't work, there's going to be a fourth one and a fifth one. And if that doesn't work, there's going to be a new vaccine. I mean, this is, you know, and I hope it's obvious. I'm being sarcastic here. But it's at the same time, I'm not really trying to be funny for the sake of being funny here. This is the way the system works. Ultimately, we're talking of the problems here are about deeply rooted conflicts of interest and corruption. And as long as we talk about this in sort of medical scientific terms, we're going to be opposed by the quote-unquote authorities and experts who have a different point of view and their medical studies they can point to and so forth and so on. It's really, and I'm not suggesting we stop making these arguments. We need to keep making them, and we need to keep making them until they see the light of day and the corruption and so forth is ultimately exposed. But we can expect until such time that we break this issue open more into the mainstream and have it truly exposed for what it is, that the solution to any problem that's acknowledged is going to be more of whatever it is that keeps, maintains, or increases pharmaceutical profits. And so, of course, that's the direction they're going to go with this. But it's, how far can they go with that before it falls apart? It's really interesting, you know, that here there are lawsuits, plural, claiming fraud with the manufacturer of the mumps vaccine over at least a period of about 10 years. There's at least two lawsuits that I'm aware of currently. Now, because somebody files a lawsuit doesn't mean there was ever a problem, although, of course, it certainly suggests it very strongly, but the courts haven't ruled on that yet, so we don't know, you know, what the legal decision is, which even that may or may not reflect physical reality. But let's see what the courts come up with on these cases or how they settle if they do settle. So it's a pending. If it's a pending lawsuit, it's nothing to formally base a decision on in terms of the action you take. It certainly is something to be aware of, and to go forward with more vaccines despite the lawsuit certainly has some political risks attached to it. But I think we just have to see how these things are going to play out.
Well, I think that we can take a note from the veterinarian community, because they're finding that animals that get repeated annual booster shots end up with very, very bad illnesses. And you can find out about this by Googling, by searching online, whether people are asking, do my cat and dog need to get boosters every year. And you're going to find out that the medical community is holding back. You're not going to have to do that anymore. And so I think that we have to, we're all animals, and we're all going to respond physically to these vaccinations. And I think that this is an important issue, and we need to look across the board at how it works out. And if they're doing, we're all guinea pigs, obviously, from vaccinations, our children are. And what are the concerns that people have about autoimmune disease, and why we don't want to put these harmful toxins into our body and bypass the natural immunity. So you can read about that anywhere, but we need to look at why the veterinarian community is taking it to heart a little bit more.
You know, Debbie, just this morning, someone emailed me an article from Dogs Naturally magazine. And I've already got it posted on the website. If you go to vaccinerights.com, go to the exemptions page, exemptions link at the top, and near the bottom I have a short section on animals. There's a link that goes to, will take you to this article. But they're talking about how there's research that shows that a single dose of a vaccine will usually generate protection for the life of a dog or a cat. Why are they doing these boosters over and over again? And again, anytime something doesn't look reasonable in the medical field, you know, the first answer is usually the correct one if the answer is because it's more profitable. If you're wondering why something,
well, I think the other reason is, I think, compliance, that they do want people to comply with what they have decided is the proper way of health care. And so giving a little infant who's newly born, who has absolutely zero immunity, an injection for a disease that they most likely will never get, just so that they're under compliance, I think, you know, we got to rethink that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Unfortunately, more and more people are rethinking it, and that's the first step. The next step is to become legislatively active if and as you're able to, and NVICadvocacy.org is a great site to go to for that, for folks who are not already signed up. NVICadvocacy.org to stay abreast of vaccine legislative issues in your state and around the country. You know, there was another interesting article, Debbie, I see we're already coming in on the last few minutes here, that I thought I would see if
Go
I
ahead.
Could bring in here. This comes from a court in Randolph County, West Virginia. Now, West Virginia is one of the two states that has only medical exemption for vaccines required for school enrollment, the other one being Mississippi. A judge says that the Randolph County Board of Education must continue to provide homebound instruction to a high school senior who has refused the state-mandated vaccines. And the parents have religious objections. There is no religious exemption in West Virginia, but the way the law is worded in West Virginia, and this is not true in every state, but in West Virginia, you can avoid the vaccines if you homeschool. So the parents have religious objections to vaccines. They're homeschooling their child, and yet saying, you know, we have this federal constitutional right, you know, or objection to vaccines. You don't really have the right to a religious exemption per se, but in West Virginia. But they're saying they still have a right to an education. And the judge actually said the county still has to provide this child with an education, even though the child is staying home, mm-hmm. because of the parents' religious objections to immunization. So this is really interesting.
So you're going to take a closer look at this one. Is the school obligated to give a child tutorials at home if they become ill, if they have like a long-term illness? I kind of remember somebody in my classroom having that happen to them.
Well, I'll use North Carolina as an example, because the laws on this may vary from state to state.
Okay.
And I'm not crystal clear on it here in North Carolina. But the starting place is, in North Carolina, we have a state constitutional right to a public education. And so the question has arisen for me on more than one occasion, because most states, including North Carolina, if there's an outbreak, they define here and increasingly, I think, in around the rest of the country, anything more than the usual, which means a single case of chickenpox, even if it happens in a vaccinated kid, that's an outbreak. And so if your child is not immunized because of exercising a religious exemption, your child has to stay home for the incubation period, which they define as 21 days. It's actually 10 to 21 days, but they pick the maximum. And I've always thought, or certainly in more recent years, that's discriminatory because, as I mentioned just earlier in this show, vaccines don't work in everybody, and they don't make the immunized non-immune kids, the kids whose vaccines didn't work, they don't make them stay home during an outbreak, and there's more of them than there are the exempt children. But none of them, nobody tests to find out which of the kids are not immune and makes them stay home too, of the vaccinated kids who are not immune. So to me it seems discriminatory if you're, you know, it's violating your free exercise of religion. But, and that's, in other words, I don't think they should make the unvaccinated kids stay home at all unless they're treating everybody who's not immune the same way. And I think the practical solution is that they shouldn't make anybody stay home. They should just immediately inform all the parents and say, look, vaccines don't work in everyone, and some non-vaccinated people have natural immunity. There's been an outbreak, so whether you're vaccinated or not, you now have the choice to stay home in case you think you're not protected, or you might want to go get your children tested to find out if they're protected. But basically, it should be the parent's choice about whether or not to keep the child home and whether or not to test the child to see if they're immune. It should not be the school just picking on the people with religious objections who are exercising a federal First Amendment right.
But you know what the answer is going to be. No parent is going to want to keep their child home because they got to go out and work in order to provide for the family.
It should be the parent's choice, because otherwise it's discriminating. And the parents will do whatever they do with that. There probably would be some parents who would be afraid and keep their kids home or run out and get their kid tested. I bet there would be some. Probably most wouldn't. But I bet there'd be somebody do that. But let's go back to the current law, which says the kid has to stay home. Does the state still have to provide a child an education? And I think the legal answer is yes. The child is home because of exercising a federal constitutional right and also a state statutory and constitutional right. But the federal law is a higher legal authority, so that's the stronger part here. They're staying home because of a federal right. I don't think the state has the right to deprive them of an education because they're because they are exercising a federal right. But what happens is the kids stay home. They don't get any schooling unless the parents go to whatever efforts they have to go to get, you know, work from the school and the teachers and bring it home to the kids. Or the child who's at home.
Can I ask you this?
Sure.
You know, there are only a certain number of school days that you're allowed to miss and stay and move up to the next level of education. Is this involved in that, or is this not counted?
It's a really interesting question. I had somebody, I think it was in Alabama, call me once and say they're Georgia or Alabama, and the child was being required to stay home because somebody had the chicken pox, and the school told them they were going to be unexcused absences, which is even worse. It's not the same issue you just mentioned, because excused or not, if you go beyond a certain level, the question is raised. But I don't think that question is an absolute automatic. If you have more than this number of days, you're automatically failed. You have to repeat the grade. It's after a certain number of days, there is a question about whether or not you should go forward. Because I actually encountered that personally when I was a senior in high school. I was out more than the minimum or maximum number of allowable days, but I still graduated. They still let me graduate, and I still graduated and very near the top of my class. It really boiled down to, I think in my case anyway, had I demonstrated that despite the large number of absences that I had attained the level of education needed to meet the state requirements. In my case, clearly I had.
Right. You're an exception to the rule, Alan. So
maybe. in some regards, whether that's good or bad depends on which exception you're talking about. But
I mean that you attain success, because most of the kids who graduate don't attain success, don't attain the amount of education that they should, and they go on to college. So
Well, that's increasingly the case these days. But I think if a child is home because of some extended illness or injury, some non-vaccine or infectious disease related issue, I think they still have a right to a public education. But I don't really know the precise answer as to how that plays out and who has to do what in terms of the school or the parents and so forth. It's an interesting question, and the answer may vary from state to state.
I think perhaps due to technology, the answer may end up to be distance education will be the answer across the board, and people will then have to fulfill their school assignment requirements in this way. And that is potentially a way that the school districts can solve the problem of kids who are not able to attend school for one reason or another. That's only my idea.
Well, it's a great idea in the sense, from the school's point of view, in the sense that it potentially skirts the question about what is their literal legal obligation. It's sort of like you can still stay home. We don't have to create a new facility for you to go to and provide bus transportation for you or whatever, or we don't have to send a tutor to your home, which, of course, nobody's going to have or spend the money on, unless they're required to. In this West Virginia case, the county's ordered to provide this child an education, so it's going to be interesting to see how they fulfill that. And the case, at least by implication in the article, is up on appeal, so it may end up being the West Virginia Supreme Court that ultimately resolves the issue. So I'll keep you posted on any future updates that I hear. But this will be interesting to see. With the the internet, people could get what they need, and the question, I guess, is how far is the school going to feel that they need to go or should go? Do the individual teachers have to take extra time to deal with the kids who are home and sick, or is there another person who does that on behalf of the teachers and the student at home? Who knows? We'll have to see.
Well, I want to thank you for a very lively, fun, humorous and serious discussion today. It was great talking to you. November 15, 2012. We're already in the middle of the month, and we're heading up. Next week is Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
is that right?
I guess we'll be off next week then.
We have a time off. Yes, so I'm going to wish you a happy Turkey Day or Tofurkey Day or whatever it is that you do. and have some delicious sweet potatoes. And an apple a day keeps the doctor away, as we did learn. I want folks to know how to reach you and the PandemicResponseProject.com. And is there, and also your e-guide for giving you people a baseline of information about their legal rights for exemptions and waivers, and also to go to NVICAdvocacyPortal.org if they want to get legislative.
It's just NVICAdvocacy.org.
Advocacy.org, and people can learn what's happening in their state. And to just be educated to know what's going on there, and if they find something that they are passionate about, to get involved. And always, always tweet it up, put it on Facebook, copy the widget, and put that HTML code onto your website so people can listen right from your own website and stay there with you. Ask us questions. Send us comments. And we will try to answer them on our following shows.
All right.
Anything else that you want to say?
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. And look forward to seeing you on the other side as we roll into the next holiday season.
Yes. And I'm going to continue for another 56 minutes talking about homeopathy, how to practice medicine based on the writings of Dr. Herbert Roberts, who is... like, I actually consider him a guru. I mean, he is phenomenal. If you ever get a chance to listen in and tune in, Alan, I think you will absolutely love it. So I know you've got a busy day, and we'll talk to you next time. Okay?
Take care, Debbie.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Well, we are back. I hope you were able to get a drink of water and whatever you needed to do in between when we had listening to the beautiful voice and lyrics and music from Alan Phillips, attorney at law in North Carolina, who does help you with all of your legal questions if you would just contact him and give him a call. And now we're going to do a continuation of some readings that I've been doing over the past number of months, interspersed in some of my shows here on Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community. And we're going to be talking about the Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD. And he lived from 1868 to 1950. So he was almost a contemporary of mine. By the time he died, I was just about to be born. And so a little bit about him. Dr. Roberts was a well-known and is a well-known homeopathic doctor for his philosophy and theory. He has written so many wonderful articles, and that's what we're going to be doing reading. He was born in Connecticut, and his primary education, he was admitted in public school in Winsted and completed high school and then went on to medical school at the New York Homeopathic Medical College. And from there, he had a practice, and in 1896, he graduated from the Brattleboro of Vermont. He practiced for 3 years, and then he closed that and went to Shelton, Connecticut. He started his clinic in Elizabeth Street at Derby, Connecticut, across from the Housatonic River, and practiced for 50 years. He was a member of the Connecticut Homeopathic Medical Society, and he was president for 2 years, in 1904 to 1906. He really had took a lot of stations in the society and was elected to the membership of the International Hahnemannian Association in 1910 and became the president of the organization for 10 years. He also was the treasurer of the International Hahnemannian Association. And we're just going to be, Dr. Roberts, it says, was the only and first man to serve in the United States Army Medical Corps during the World War. Must have been World War II, with the rank of first lieutenant. He was the master of homeopathic philosophy and command of the Materia Medica. And that is like our encyclopedia of all of the homeopathic medicines that we have. And he has written quite a bit about it. And so we're going to just go ahead, and we're on chapter 5, but I want to just finish up with the questions that we learned in chapter 4, which was on Wednesday at noon, if you want to listen to the last show. We learned to what we attribute the growth and development of the individual. We learned what the direction of growth is. We learned the answer to the major question, what is health and what is disease? And he talked about the miasms and what their effect is on the development of an individual. How do we look at acute disease? And what conditions are self-curative? Well, that answer, that question follows the previous question, which was acute diseases may be self-curative without needing additional outside sources of energy. And how do we regard such conditions as semi-chronic or chronic skin manifestations and discharges and the like? Well, when it becomes chronic, it's no longer acute. It's a recurring illness, and therefore the body, the immune system, the vital force has not been able to withstand it, not been able to actually annihilate it and get it out of the body, and therefore it just keeps developing within the body. What is the order of cure? And then we learned about Herring's Law from the present state of disease, going back in history from the securing the most vital organs to the least vital, from the inside out and from the top down. And this is probably basic fundamental philosophy understanding of watching and observing the disease dissipate and leave the body in probably most alternative practices, medical practices, and Chinese medicine. So that's the importance of that. Now we're going to read on to chapter 5, and I appreciate folks in the chat. If you're a guest listening in, I welcome your comments. I'll try and pay attention to that as I read and comment here. We're talking about the vital energy in its universal application. The vital energy is that force which animates each individual. While the vital energy is in the individual, that individual is said to have life, to be, and to exist. And you know what? I believe I may have even read this Wednesday, yes. And so we're going to probably move on. I'll give you a synopsis of what we learned here. We learned that it takes only an infinitesimal amount of energy to challenge and move that energy force within the human being. It could be a thought. It could be a homeopathic potentized remedy. It could be the sound of laughter. It could be music. It could be a smile. The smallest infinitesimal amount of energy or action that is required to change and make an effect in the body. And so that is chapter 5. We're going to move on. And just to close up again, he says that there's three forms of action that has vital force, play on the vital force, and that is motion, direction, and balance, which Dr. Herbert Roberts is basically coming to the common denominator of all life being mathematics, physics, and also spiritual energy, because there is a mysterious part that plays in moving all of these energies. And you can see that in the movement of the stars, the planets, the galaxies, in the plants and the way they're formed and growth. And when we see something being born, this is miraculous. Now we're going to move on to chapter 6, homeopathy and the fundamental laws. Among the followers of Hahnemann, and Hahnemann is the founder of homeopathy, we often hear the statement that homeopathy is fundamental, that it is scientific, that it is based on natural law. Let us grant, for the sake of argument, that this is true. And this is really cool, because in our previous hour, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, likes to do that same thing. For the sake of argument, as a lawyer, for the sake of argument, let us hold that this is true. In other words, let's move forward and understand what the outcome is of this as a hypothesis. Dr. Robert says, the natural corollary of this statement is that these laws must be active in all realms of fundamental science. For example, that in those sciences that deal with the established laws of the universe, the same natural laws must be active. It is self-evident that natural laws must work, not in contradiction to each other, but in sympathy and cooperation. These laws are fixed and immutable. Basically, he's saying true is true, and you're not going to mess that up. You're not going to change that. If we have the law of gravity, then it's for all time until you find an exception to that rule. That which sets the planet in its orbit so regulates the other planets that they obey the same laws. Their difference lies not in the governing laws, but in time, distance, and circumstance, which is, again, ruled by law. If the planets moved at random, lawlessly, the result would be chaos. And we do see chaos when we talk about cancer cells, that they do not follow the law of nature, do they not? And that's why we call it chaotic growth and unnatural. But let's go on. Dr. Robert says, so too, if one realm of the universe was moved by fundamental laws which had no application or relation to other realms of the universe, the result must be chaos. If one science is seemingly governed by laws which are contradictory to those of another science, one must be lawless, not a science, or not science, but chaos would be the result. So here we see that he's telling us, if something is true, is a truth, is a fundamental law, is a natural law, it's going to cross the board of all sciences, whether it is chemistry, physics, biology, astronomy, whatever it is, there's going to be these fundamental laws that's going to be immutable. So too, if one realm of the universe was moved by the fundamental laws, which had no application or relation to other realms in the universe, the result would be chaos. And just take a look at chaos in our lives today. We must not be doing something that abides by these laws. So he says, if homeopathy is a fundamental science or a part of a fundamental science, as we believe it must work in harmony with all the natural realms and the laws which apply relation to homeopathy. So he says, if homeopathy is a fundamental science, it's got to fit in with all these other natural laws. In spite of the years that have been devoted to the study of homeopathy with their accumulated data, we glimpse by dimly the possibilities of these conclusions. When we realize the confusion that man has caused in his individual life in every sphere, it is little wonder that he has misunderstood the natural powers and resources and has failed to make use of natural laws. It is not strange, then, that medicine, among many other phases of our modern life, is but a series of experimental groupings without form or order. So even in his day and age, in the 1800s leading and the mid-1900s, he found chaos in the medical profession, in the medical science, that we were not using these natural laws. The glimpse at our present state of social confusion cannot excuse our refusal to substantiate our claim that homeopathy is based on natural laws. Let us consider the place homeopathy must hold if our contentions be true. If homeopathy is founded upon fundamental laws, what are some of those laws? Our ignorance permits us to register but a few, but inevitably the time will come, if we keep a clear vision, when we will be able to add more to our burden of proof. And from the time he died, 1950, to 2012, going on to 2013, we've had a good number of decades pass where we have invested a tremendous amount in technology and in science and in research. Have we come further along? Do we have more proof that homeopathy is founded upon fundamental laws? Well, let's see what Dr. Robert says. Let us look at the first formulated and recognized law of homeopathy, similia similibus curantur. Whence came this law, the law of similars, likes cures likes? It was simply an intelligent observation of our natural resources, those in our closest proximity to our daily lives in the vegetable kingdom, and their relation to disturbed and disordered conditions arising in mankind himself. It was found that the ills of individual man could be successfully treated thus. First, doubtless, these substances were found in the vegetable kingdom, later in the mineral and animal kingdom also. Still later came the knowledge that this was not by chance an occasional means of cure, but that by law these substances acted in an ordered and orderly manner under certain definite conditions and circumstances. So, too, you know, you can think about the behavior of everything. Is there an order? And this is why we see spirit and creation and creator, that there is order in the movement direction of the stars and the planets and everything on earth. That is the natural occurrence. When the sun rises and sets, when the moon is out, the turning of the rotation of the earth, all of these things, the magnetic forces of the earth, electricity and everything else that we have is seen in a planned order, and therefore you can count on it and you can depend upon it working out in a certain sequence. Dr. Robert says, this recognition of law underlying cure is of ancient origin. No one knows when the first recognition of this law crept into use, but ancient Hindu manuscripts recorded its application. Certainly Aristotle recognized it, and Hippocrates sensed the possibilities of this law and applied it in some recorded cases. From time to time, all through medical history, this hypothesis was enunciated or demonstrated in greater or less degree. Hahnemann later demonstrated this law to be universal and not an occasional circumstance. He called the science and art of healing, which naturally followed, he called it homeopathy. But the thought was not a new one. It was age old before a science of healing was based solely on this law. In other words, in even the embryonic stages of homeopathy, it was found that law governed. Gradual experimentation widened the possibilities of application of these laws. So how can we apply these laws once we learn and know and recognize and admit that, yes, these are truisms? No amount of experimentation extended the laws themselves. All that experimentation could do was to enlighten our minds regarding the scope of the law. So the laws are there. How do we use, we can't, you know, he's saying no amount of experimentation is going to extend them. But what about enlightening ourselves to the scope of the law? How can we utilize this law if we know that an apple's going to fall when we drop it? the law of gravity, how have we applied this principle? How have we resisted this principle and shot rockets up into space? What are the forces of nature and how can you utilize them? A law is a fundamental fact. Because we do not recognize a law does not mean that the law does not exist. Cool. I like that. He would love to be living in North Carolina right now where the state legislature has made into law that the sea level will not change. Whether it does or it doesn't, by law of the state, of our government, it will not recognize an actual state of fact in nature. So how can we do this? How can we be blinded? How can we be living in a state of denial? What does Dr. Roberts say? Even to man-made laws, which in their essence are not laws in the true sense, but rules laid down by man for man, it is recognized that ignorance of the law is no excuse. So he says even in the situations where he found that man-made laws, which is the one that I'm kind of citing here, is ignorance. And remember that everything that I say on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio is simply a discussion, a discourse, educational, informative, and is not meant as a medical assistance or aid to you. It is not meant to provide you for treatment or legal aid. You need to seek out professional help, both in the medical world by your healthcare provider or your legal attorney. So Dr. Roberts says, as observation became focused upon the unfolding of the law of cure, other regularities in reaction were discovered. And a second law of cure, this time pertaining to the direction of cure, was formulated. This was, cure takes place from above downward, from within outward, from an important organ to a less important organ, from symptoms disappearing in the reverse order of their appearance, and the first to appear beginning the last to disappear. So the first thing, if you first start off with an itch, that itch is going to be the last thing to leave your body, even though other things, maybe swelling and pus and irritation and inflammation and redness and other things occur, you're going to see that last thing, that itch, is going to be the last thing to leave. And the same thing if you have a sinus infection. What is the first thing that you notice? And then notice in yourself, be a scientist, be a researcher, be an observer, and see what is it that leaves you first. If you start with itchy eyes, are the itchy eyes going to be the first thing or the last thing to leave? So this is basically what he says is what he's learned upon natural laws, laws of cure, through observation. Simple disappearance of symptoms is by no means cure. That's interesting. Symptoms often have periods of recurrence, but no true cure has ever been observed that did not follow the direction of the law of direction. Another law, equally applicable throughout the universe, is the mutual action. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. I will repeat that. Another law, equally applicable throughout the universe, is that of mutual action. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. I think that Dr. Einstein would probably corroborate with that one. Everybody, balance your equation. To some of us who have thoughtfully considered these things, they seem so self-evident that it would be almost unnecessary to speak of them were it not for the purpose of urging you to observe the lawfulness of homeopathy and to prove our claim of the fundamental lawfulness of this true science of healing. Let us look at a law which follows naturally the law of mutual action. You know, it's really interesting that we're discussing law after the show of legal exemptions and freedoms and waivers for choosing to not vaccinate, that law is both immutable law, what man and man-made law, the two kinds of laws. This is the law designated as the law of least action, which was formulated by Maupertuis, the French mathematician. To us, as homeopathic physicians and students, it may be known as the law of quantity and dose, the quantity of action necessary to effect any change in nature is the least possible. The decisive amount is always a minimum, an infinitesimal. So this is a repeat that he told us in the previous chapter. The law, the quantity of action necessary to effect a change in nature is the least possible, and the decisive amount is always a minimum, an infinitesimal. Health is a matter of perfect equilibrium, perfect balance. Trifling circumstances may sway it, and even as seemingly trifling circumstances may sway it, it may be in, may it be balanced by the least possible in medication, which may, in conditions of perfect health, cause the same loss of balance or a corresponding loss of equilibrium. So therefore, he's saying if by law of nature, nature's law says, use the smallest, most infinitesimal amount in order to create this action, to make an effective change, to create both perfect equilibrium and perfect balance. And when we then give a person, an individual, a living force, something that is in a large amount beyond the infinitesimal minimal amount, but a drug dose, that you're going to have the opposite effect. You're going to have an unbalancing, the corresponding loss of equilibrium, which in today's world we may be calling side effects from drugs or seeing mental disease and disorder and seeing unhappy people walking around, seeing people who become violent and aggressive, and they are not happy people. There is no perfect equilibrium or balance in their lives. They do not have coping skills, and therefore we need to take a closer look at the natural laws. Another law of quantity to be considered here is the quantity of the drug required is in inverse ratio to the similarity. So he's not saying if one aspirin works, take two. In other words, he says, the greater the similarity of the drug symptoms to those of the patient, the less quantity will be required, for the greater will be the state of susceptibility of the patient. Therefore, this is homeopathic repertorization, homeopathically finding the similar drug. So the resonant qualities of the drug medicine, the homeopathic remedy, which is potentized to the infinitesimal amount, the smallest amount needed, the less is going to be required, the more on target you are, the more you've hit the bullseye of the correct resonant medicine for the state that matches the state of the individual, because that person is going to be most susceptible to resonating with that entity, with that similar drug. Dr. Roberts says, a corollary to the law of quantity is the quality of the action of a homeopathic remedy is determined by its quantity in inverse ratio. Remember, Dr. Roberts constantly goes back to mathematics and physics. Again, this is a problem of the susceptibility of the patient and the similarity of the drug. The laws of quality and quantity go hand in hand. Biology gives us this law, which is function creates and develops the organ. It has been observed in the study of homeopathy that functional symptoms are produced by the vital force in exact proportion to the profundity of the disturbance. Often, however, when pathology changes occur, the symptomatic picture changes greatly in that functional symptoms do not manifest themselves in as great a degree. The disease condition has struck deeper and manifests itself less on the surface. Following the biological law, therefore, homeopathy postulates the law of symptom development. So here's another law of homeopathy, which states, functional symptoms precede structural changes. Functional symptoms precede structural changes. What does this tell us? This tells us that we're going to observe symptoms in the individual before pathology. We're going to get cues and clues and signals to something that's happening within the vital force, within the equilibrium and balance of an individual before we see the structural changes in the organs. Now, he says, the law of use governing the homeopathic remedy must therefore be, quote, the dose and quantity that will thoroughly permeate the organism and make its essential impress upon the vital force is that which will affect the functional sphere of the individual. So he's saying, let's get to it, folks, physicians and students who are going to be physicians out there, because that's who he's addressing. We need to take a close look at the dose and quantity of the drug that's going to cause some kind of a change in the functional sphere, not the pathological or structural spheres, but the functional sphere of the individual. What's going to change their outlook on life, their emotional balance, their mental state of being, their coping skills, and some of the small functional changes and symptoms, such as a little bit of inflammation, a little bit of swelling, a little bit of a rash, some sneezing, some runny nose. What are those things? What are the clues, cues, signals, and symptoms that are going to tell us where we need to find a remedy for that so we can get back into balance? We say this must therefore be, if we reason logically and have observed carefully, keeping our line of reasoning along the lines of laws already formulated and proven sound, we can do no less than believe that this is a truly fundamental law. So he's talking about laws and you know, immutable truths. And how can you go wrong with that if you practice that way, if you understand it, if you bring it into your heart, if you make it part of your being and understanding, then you're going to be practicing true medicine. Quote, Dr. Roberts says, for many years, daily practice has proven the value of the law of repetition of the dose. Never repeat your remedy so long as it continues to act. That's a law of homeopathy. Never repeat your remedy so long as it continues to act. And you're going to find today many homeopathic practitioners are giving their remedy to the patient daily, twice daily, weekly. They're repeating the dose. And they're able to do that because based on this law, the question is, the tail end of the statement, as long as it continues to act. And if a person today is taking drugs or the potency of the remedy is only last for a day, then you have to repeat the remedy. And the person is going to be self-observing and knowledgeable and understand that, gee, I feel good taking my remedy once a day or once a week or every other day, then it's a partnership between the homeopath and the patient to understand when it is needed and rely upon the correspondence and communicating with the patient of how they are doing. This is called progress. So Dr. Roberts says, this governs the administration of remedies to individuals and states of disease. Let us look at the law that must govern the production of symptoms by artificial means. For instance, drug provings. by which we get our guidance for the administration of drugs to the sick. And so what he's talking about are clinical provings of homeopathic drugs and the documentation of how long a particular remedy will be effective in a healthy person who is now receiving these drugs and documenting what happens to their symptoms. The object of proving drugs is the production of artificial diseases that we may observe the symptoms and apply the substances so proven in like states of natural disturbance. So in the clinical trials, proving of remedies, we want to then be able to use that particular drug, that homeopathic remedy, for a person who has a natural disease rather than in the proving initiating an artificial disease or the initial artificial symptoms that will not be lifelong, but they will be during the duration of the proving. The law governing this must be closely allied to the law of administration in states of disease, and or else our case is not logical. And Dr. Roberts likes to be logical. He likes to be rational. He likes to rely on laws that govern the universe. We find this law, which is never repeat the dose in a proving while symptoms are manifest from the dose already taken. So he's giving us a guideline for how to do a proving, that if you take the drug one time and you're still eliciting symptoms, then you do not repeat that same drug again. Again, granting that homeopathy is allied to all nature, we must concede that orbits or cycles of action are a fundamental part of natural manifestations. So also we find that the homeopathic remedies have cycles of development and recession. If the natural cycle of symptom development is interfered with, we gain no knowledge of the true nature of the substance being proved. At best, we can get but a distorted comprehension of its nature when there is any interference. And I hope you understood that. Basically, he's saying that everything in nature has its own rhythm, its cycle, its night and day, its orbit, its rotation, its curvature of epidemic and contagious disease, how it comes and goes in regions, in continents, in neighborhoods, what happens with our life cycles, that everything has a development of increasing ascension and recession. So he says if you're going to interfere by giving a second dose of a remedy during a proving, you're going to mess up to be able to observe very clearly that natural cycle, that natural law taking place. And so you're going to get a distorted comprehension of what nature would normally do in a natural disease. So he says, continuing to administer repeatedly a remedy while it is producing disease symptoms in a prover would make chaos out of a normal cycle of disease symptoms, which have been in process of development. This is simply the result of logical reasoning. And so you can see he returns us back to chaos when we don't have order. Examining still further into laws of governing the production of artificial disease states, we find that there are laws governing the various states or types of substances which we desire to prove. As yet, we may find these laws crudely phrased, but they follow closely the law of mutual action, the law of least action, and the laws of quantity and quality. And here he states these three laws. Any drug which in its natural state affects the vital energy, but little will develop a proving only in a high potency. Interesting. Any drug which in its natural state affects the vital energy but little will develop a proving only in a high potency, which means that if you're doing the proving of a remedy in a 6C, a 30C, a 200C, and nothing is really developing in terms of symptomatology in a healthy person, then he says you need to go to a higher potency, 1M, 10M, 50M. Number two, any drug which in its natural state disturbs the vital energy to functional manifestations only may be proven in a crude form. And he just discussed this functional manifestations, meaning signs, symptoms of disease or changes of action in the body that are not organic yet, not structural, but just functional. If you have a drug which in its natural state disturbs the vital force in a prover to the functional manifestations, let's say they do, you take the drug one time and it elicits a rash, or even repeatedly and it elicits a rash or a swelling or an itch or a discharge, then it says only may be proven in a crude form. So that means that when it's a functional manifestation only, then you can prove this drug in a crude form. So you can take something, I'm trying to think of anything that you want. You can take chickpea, or you can take, I'm thinking the chemical in aspirin, you can take from the willow. So you can prove the willow tree in a crude form and also find that it works. So that's why aspirin works in a crude form. It works functionally and in the functional manifestations. Just that's why it works for us. Number three, any drug which in its natural state disturbs the vital energy to destructive manifestations should be proven only in a potentized form or potentiated form. So these kinds of drugs really make a destructive action when in the proving. So now we need to be very careful and use the infinitesimal minimum dose of the potentized form. It has been demonstrated that planetary movements have a definite relationship to life. The power of the moon over the tides is an ancient and constant observation. The relationship of the earth and the sun offers an irrefutable argument in favor of the correlation of the planetary influences. The influence of the phases of the moon on some mental conditions and nervous complaints has been noted from the earliest times. For instance, the appellation lunacy designated a mental disturbance definitely related to moon phases. Epileptic conditions also have shown some response to the cycles of the moon. In other words, through these abnormal conditions of mental and nervous disturbance, we have perceived dimly from time to time the outlines of a great truth. And women know that their menses, their menstruation cycles will align with the moon. When you go into any emergency room, hospital, and you will find that pregnancies, births occur during a full moon in a larger quantity. You will find that people coming into hospitals for emergency situations, watch out for that full moon again. So the fact that we are electric, we are energy beings, and we are affected by magnetic force, by gravity, by the pull of the tides, by the pull of the planets around, circling around in the gravitational pull, that we are being affected by these cycles. And so these are immutable truths, but we need to observe them, outline them, utilize them. That cyclic manifestations, says Roberts, have been demonstrated in other fields than medicine is easily seen from the most cursory glance at the science of astronomy. In its earlier stages, astronomy suffered from the same blind, groping ignorance and superstition that has hampered the intelligent observation of all natural phenomena. Nevertheless, it has emerged as a true science of mathematical exactness. It is still true that the deductions from the most careful measurements and computations vary between different schools, yet it is the most closely measurable of all the sciences today. Let us quote from The Concise Knowledge of Astronomy History by Agnes M. Clark, pages 12 and 13. Quote, "The subjection of the moon to known law was completed by the dispersal of the mystery surrounding a slight continuous acceleration of her orbital velocity detected by Halley in 1693. I think he's talking about Halley's Comet. It has been in progress since the earliest recorded eclipse in 721 BC, before the Common Era, if not longer. There was no sign of its cessation or reversal, and the grave question arose. Was the principle of universal attraction elsewhere unreservedly obeyed, here fatally complicated by the action of a resisting medium involving the eventual collapse of the Earth-Moon system? Laplace gave the answer in 1787 by proving the observed quickening of pace to be a necessary and simple consequence of a secular diminution in the elliptically of the Earth's orbit. This, however, will not go on forever in the same direction. After many ages, the tide of change will turn, and a complete restoration to status quo ante will ensue. Ruinous disturbances were shown to be excluded by the overwhelming disparity of mass between the central body and its attendants, no less than by the regularity slight oscillatory changes can occur. Millions of years will elapse, is so beautifully adjusted as to right itself automatically through the mutual action of its various parts, and it is the force which perturbs that eventually restores." And so that is really scientific jargon, basically saying when Halley's Comet came, it disturbed the elliptical action and of the Earth's orbit, but with that leaving and the other planets there to readjust, make adjustments, the elliptical pattern of the orbit of the Earth is going to go back to where it was, unless it gets another disturbance. Dr. Herbert says, "Let us repeat the last lines of this quotation in the light of our observation in the relation of homeopathy and the fundamental laws." He says, "The machine is so beautifully adjusted as to right itself automatically through the mutual action of its various parts, and it is the force which perturbs that eventually restores." And so I guess that's why in acute disease, temporarily, we may not feel good. We may be disturbed and disordered and feel chaotic or out of balance. But if it's just an acute disturbance, temporary, then we're going to go and we're going to right ourselves. We're going to get back into orbit. Dr. Robert says, "This last observation, acknowledged by the most exact of all science and a deduction from observation of the most observable of all cyclic phenomena, is equally pertinent to homeopathy and our belief in the lawful flow of vital energy. This deduction, so fundamental that it might well be called a law, is closely allied to the law of mathematics, which is the quantity of action necessary to effect any change in nature is the least possible. These are but a few of the laws which we, in our ignorance, have assembled from the vast resources at our command to demonstrate that homeopathy is governed by laws that are universal, and that homeopathy, therefore, is a part of the fundamental lawfulness and orderliness of the universe. If we can apply a known law of biology, a known law of mathematics, and a known and accepted deduction of astronomy, we can as surely apply the tested laws of any other sphere of universal activity. At some future time, we will be able to formulate definitely those laws which govern the vital force and its action in the human economy. This vital energy, which is the sun of our individual human economy, has a distinct relationship to universal vital energy. It is vital energy in the individual, which offers homeopathy its scientific demonstration of healing. Of this mystery, we now comprehend but this. The state of the disordered vital energy is the state in which homeopathy offers the greatest hope of regaining the lost balance of power in each individual, and that not by coercion of the vital force, but by so stimulating it that the equilibrium is restored by the same force that disturbed it. That the vital energy in itself is capable of disturbance and of self-restoration under the proper circumstances. We have used the laws of homeopathy half-blindly, as it were, yet we recognize their tremendous significance and their possibilities. We have observed their action in countless cases of human misery. So let it be so, let it be read, that anyone who says there is no evidence for homeopathy here in the 1800s and the early 1900s, the first half of the 1900s, Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD, says that we recognize that their tremendous significance and possibilities. We have observed their action in countless cases of human misery. Let us be alert to observe and accurate to correlate the plain facts before us, that we may recognize, formulate, and work in accord with the fundamental laws that govern homeopathy and all nature. And so now he's going to give us some of these laws. He's going to list them for us. Homeopathic laws of cure. Similia similibus curentur. Cure takes place from up above downward, from within outward, from the more important to the less important organ, and in the reverse order of the onset of the symptoms. And the law, homeopathic law of action. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. Homeopathic law of quantity and dose. The quantity of the drug required is in inverse ratio to the similarity. The homeopathic law of quantity. The quantity of action necessary to effect any change in nature is the least possible. The decisive amount is always a minimum and infinitesimal amount. The homeopathic law of quality. The quality of the action of a homeopathic remedy is determined by its quantity in inverse ratio. Remember your math. Homeopathic law of use. The dose and quantity that will thoroughly permeate the organism and make its essential impression upon the vital force is that which will affect the functional sphere of the individual. And then go back and listen again. What is the function, the functional sphere? It is not a structural or pathological change. It is the signs and signals and symptoms that we see before the pathology begins. So that's the homeopathic law of use. The homeopathic law of biological development. Function creates and develops the organ. The homeopathic law of disease development. Functional symptoms are produced by the vital force in exact proportion to the profundity of the disturbance. Functional symptoms precede structural changes. We're almost at the end of the show. Homeopathic law of proving. Any drug which in its natural state affects the vital energy but little will develop a proving only in a high potency. So if it's the natural state affects the vital energy but little, only a little bit, will develop a proving only in a high potency. The homeopathic law of proving any drug which in its natural state disturbs the vital energy to functional manifestations only may be proven only in a potentized form. Any drug which in its natural state disturbs the vital energy to destructive manifestations should be proven only in a potentized form. The homeopathic law of repetition for provings: never repeat the dose while symptoms are manifest from the dose already taken. The homeopathic law of repetition for cure: never repeat your remedy so long as it continues to act. Thank you to Dr. Herbert A. Roberts, MD, and anyone who is listening and learning with us. That was Chapter 6, Homeopathy. And I'm going to end the show. I want to thank everyone. Have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. Our best wishes to you from Homeopathy World Community.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.